Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 28, 2020, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a litigation update on Arizona versus California. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us the Honorable Mark Brnovich, who is the Attorney General of Arizona. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you to everyone that may be listening on this call. It's great to be here in sunny Arizona. Let me just start with an overview of the case. On February 25th, the U.S. Supreme Court denied Arizona's our motion for leave to file an original action against California. There was a dissent that was filed by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. Arizona's complaint alleged that California's imposition of a, quote, doing business, unquote, tax and its efforts to collect these taxes in other states without warrants or any judicial process. Basically, what California was doing was impose an $800 doing business tax on companies that were doing business in there. It assesses that tax so expansively, though, that it reaches out-of-state companies, including those in Arizona, that do not conduct any actual business in California. And I would argue have no connection to the state except for purely passive investments in California companies. We have argued that the Due Process Clause restricts a state's ability to tax out-of-state entities, and that the Supreme Court has imposed a minimum context requirement that largely mirrors the minimum context standards for personal jurisdiction. Furthermore, the Supreme Court has squarely held that passive investments do not constitute sufficient minimum context to exercise personal jurisdiction. Thus, California's tax assessments violate the Due Process Clause. Additionally, the Commerce Clause imposes four independent requirements on an out-of-state taxation. A tax violates the Commerce Clause unless it is, one, applied to an activity with a substantial nexus with the taxing state, two, is fairly apportioned, three, is non-discriminatory, that is, it doesn't discriminate against interstate commerce, and four, is fairly related to the services provided by the state. Although failing any one of these requirements is constitutionally fatal, Arizona's complaint alleges that California's tax manages to violate all four of them. So the amount of taxes here is substantial. Arizona estimates that these assessments exceed $10 million a year just here in Arizona, and likely more than $100 million nationally. So if a business doesn't pay these taxes voluntarily to the state of California, the state of California frequently procures funds through extraterritorial seizures, which are both non-judicial and warrantless. Specifically, California will find money in out-of-state bank accounts for the tax companies and then send the relevant banks demand letters. Those letters instruct the banks to transfer the requested funds or else California will take the money from the banks instead. Those seizure demands are issued ex parte without any warrant, without any judicial involvement, and expressly preclude the banks from seeking judicial review. And in a remarkable bit of Orwellian logic, California's brief defends the demand letters as, quote, voluntary compliance. So our complaint alleged that these extraterritorial seizures violated the Due Process Clause since California has neither in personam jurisdiction over the out-of-state companies nor in rem jurisdiction over the out-of-state funds. We have further argued that the seizures violate the Fourth Amendment since the seizures are warrantless, non-judicial, and not supported by probable cause and are unreasonable. So we know that in the dissent that was written by Justice Thomas and joined by Justice Alito, they dissented from the denial of the motion to leave, and they specifically said, and I'm quoting from this from their dissent, that the Constitution establishes our original jurisdiction in mandatory terms. Article 3 states that, quote, in all cases in which the state is a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction, Section 2, Clause 2. In these circumstances, we have no more right to decline the exercise of jurisdiction which is given than to usurp that which is not given. Furthermore, 28 U.S.C. Section 1251A confers, quote, original and exclusive jurisdiction on all controversies between two or more states, end quote. Nothing in this text limits the jurisdiction in any way to intend it to be discretionary. and the exclusive nature of it, we would argue, strongly suggests otherwise. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court began interpreting its jurisdiction to be discretionary in the 1970s, and the court's view, its original jurisdiction, is of so delicate and grave a character that it was not contemplated that it would be exercised save when necessarily absolute. So in deciding whether to accept jurisdiction, the court considers, quote, the seriousness and dignity of the claim and the availability of another forum. So we, as I said, were denied, but I think one of the other relevant things that everyone on this call should know is that the court did call for the views of the U.S. Solicitor General on June 24th, 2019. On December 9th, the United States Solicitor General's office recommended the court deny Arizona's motion for leave to challenge California's unconstitutional taxes. I will tell you, the SG's brief was a little strange. It contended that this issue needs to be, quote, fleshed out, end quote, whether California actually imposes extraterritorial assessments based purely on passive investments. But the irony is, California has repeatedly admitted that it does just that, even in its official legal rulings. And the SG has also pointed out to similar seizures by the IRS, although we agree that the IRS, the United States, excuse me, obviously shares sovereignty in the territory of Arizona, but the state of California does not. So that led us to the February 24th, 2020 denial of our case. The Supreme Court followed the Solicitor General's advice and denied our motion for leave. That denial was not reasoned, but as I mentioned, Justices Thomas and Alito filed the dissent. The dissenting justices explained that the court likely does not have discretion to review cases which are original jurisdiction arises between two or more states. As we noted and we've argued, we believe that this is a case the court not only had to take, but should have taken, because there are impacts in other jurisdictions. There are currently two other pending motions for leave to file original actions for suits between states. Montana and Wyoming are currently seeking to challenge Washington's denial of access to its ports for coal exports. Texas is also seeking to challenge California's travel ban against Texas for state-funded travel due to Texas religious liberties law. So the decision on February 20th may have very important implications for those suits. The denial again signals that the Supreme Court not only reads its jurisdiction to be discretionary, but that it can impose a very high bar for accepting jurisdiction. Notably, neither California nor the United States have offered anything more than a token defense of the constitutionality of California's actions. But the mere possibility that California courts might reach these other issues, even though they have failed to do so for more than a decade, was apparently enough to prevent the court from taking jurisdiction. Montana, Wyoming, Texas are all likely to face substantial hurdles in convincing the court to accept their cases. And this is particularly true as both suits seek, like Arizona's, to assert Commerce Clause claims against sister states. In finality, I would just point to, you know, the brief of the National Taxpayers Union that pointed out that at the end of the day, if the Supreme Court allows these types of, you know, taxes or passive taxes to remain in effect and that a state can't challenge them, it opens up a can of worms. And as the National Taxpayers Union said, quote, quoting for their brief, that California's cross-border seizure of funds from bank accounts of Arizona residents amounts to a casus belli in the classic sense of requiring collective self-defense. But unlike conventional cross-border raids that rely on physical mobilization, technological advances allow California to reach into Arizona bank accounts without physically traveling outside its borders. This precedent, if allowed to stand, would allow any state with revenue aspirations to reach passive investors in every other state by using multi-state bank accounts as conduits for backdoor extractions. So in summary, what we would argue is that not only what California, the state of California is doing is unconstitutional, but the court made an error in not hearing our case. The Solicitor General's Office of the United States compounded that error by not wanting the court to hear, by viewing this as a case the court shouldn't hear. And third, there are serious policy implications for not only Arizona, but other states when it comes to taxation. So thank you very much, and that's the update on what happened.
We'll move on to that first caller.
This is Dave Hickman in Washington State. What kind of tax is California asserting? Is this like an income tax? How are they calculating the tax?
It's basically a franchise tax on companies, a doing business tax. And basically, it assesses the tax on passive investments. So you could have somebody that has no physical contacts, that's not actually doing business in California, but because of their investment portfolio, they literally are getting taxed on that.
So it's just a flat tax, like a certain amount of money they have to pay simply for doing business in California?
It's a flat fee, and it's $800. So basically, it's the whole notion of, you know, you assess this assessment on enough businesses, you know, it starts turning into real money.
Another question just popped in, so we'll move to that next caller.
I have a quick question regarding a case last year from Nevada on personal income taxes. Is there any relation to that with this case?
Not really. That case was really focused on sovereign immunity. So it's a little bit different of a case. And part of our, you know, argument here was, yeah, the notion that, that states like Arizona, we have to have a forum in order to challenge this taxing scheme in California, because the reality is that California courts have really done nothing. I mean, you know, our brief pointed out that there's actually a tax in California that the court there declared unconstitutional in 2008, but the class was certified 10 years later in 2018, and refunds have still not been paid 12 years after the fact. So it just shows you that there's really not a lot of forum if you're a taxpayer and you're trying to push back against the government.
We have one question in the queue right now, so we'll go ahead and move to that caller.
Hi, this is Steve Herb here in snowy Columbus, Ohio. I hope you're enjoying your Arizona sunshine. Since other states have now lost any defense against this in courts, perhaps one means to deal with this would be a quote-unquote class action of all other states against California, but not in the legal sense. I'm inferring or replying or suggesting that perhaps all other states start doing exactly the same thing to the companies that are in California and basically see how California likes it.
A couple things. One is, please say hello to my friend and colleague Dave Yost there, and I guess I would add that they're freezing up in Dayton, stuck in their cars, and I'm lying here underneath the sun and the stars. It is a gorgeous 70-plus degrees here, so anyone listening to this call in freezing weather should feel free to come out here and enjoy some spring training games. To answer your question in all seriousness, part of the problem and part of our argument was is that the Supreme Court should hear our case for the very reason that we don't want an arms race. We don't want states to get into this arms race where there are, you know, retaliatory taxes or these backdoor taxes where you have this extraterritorial jurisdiction where, you know, states are seizing people's bank accounts and putting, you know, banks in awkward positions without due process. And so we're worried that that might actually happen, that you're going to start to see more and more states do this. You know, one thing that I've learned in my life, you know, I'm fairly new to politics, but I know a lot about government. And if there's a way for a politician or a bureaucrat to tax something where, you know, they don't have to be accountable to the voters, they're going to do it. And that's the thing. So the concern is actually that more states will be doing this, and we don't want to see that retaliatory nature. But as far as, you know, class action lawsuits, that's actually one of the remedies of what really might happen here, is that you're going to have something happen in federal district court in California with taxpayers. You know, they file something, and at that point, we need to make a determination. Our office make a determination whether, you know, we would join as amici or how we would, you know, maybe support those efforts.
All right, Mr. Brunovich, is there anything else you wanted to cover today?
I appreciate everyone's time, and I know that this is one of those issues that maybe isn't as sexy as some other issues out here, but this is an important issue, and I think the fact that Justices Thomas and Alito took that further step writing that dissent is a signal that at least there's some people on the court that are really willing to look at these as mandatory jurisdiction versus discretionary jurisdiction for the court.
All right, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'll go ahead and wrap us up today. I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his very valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.